different than you centre at 5. The government says it's putting a stop to hidden credit card fees to prevent people being ripped off. Companies can push up the prices of flights, concert tickets and other goods by adding a surcharge when customers buy online. Steve Perry is the commercial director for Visa Europe and blames retailers for being greedy. He's worried they'll just find another way to fleece us.
I'd actually like to see the abolition completely of surcharging. The difficulty will be that I think many retailers will move to a different type of transaction charging. They'll call it something different, and that's what we have to watch for.
At least 40 people have been killed and 100 others injured in a twin suicide attack in Syria. State TV says the bombers packed two cars with explosives and targeted security sites in the capital, Damascus. David Cameron has joined other world leaders at the state funeral of former Czech President Václav Havel in Prague. Tens of thousands turned out to mourn the man who led the overthrow of the communist rule 22 years ago. Police have made a fresh appeal for help to trace a teenager who vanished from a Christmas party almost a week ago. Hayden Mark Evans from Mould in North Wales didn't come home from a work party at a hotel near Chester last Friday. NHS patients could be allowed to see and edit their records online. The proposal would mean you could check your whole medical history. George Michael says he's lucky to be alive after the worst month of his life in hospital with severe pneumonia. The singer's been treated in Austria and was discharged yesterday. He says it's been an emotional journey.
I spent the last 10 days since I woke up literally thanking people for saving my life, which is something I've never had to do before. Never want to have to do again.
A man who grew a large cannabis plant to look like a Christmas tree will spend the festive season behind bars. 46-year-old Ian Richards from Elsham in Kent even decorated it with baubles. He made the cannabis plant resemble a festive tree by growing it to 5 foot tall. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us discuss this week's news and review some of the big stories of 2011 is politics graduate with a Master's in International Political Economy from Warwick, Polly Winch. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, with BBC Radio Bristol's listener figures falling off a cliff, the Radar announced in October that Radio Bristol's lost half their listeners since October 2010. We ask, has Radio Bristol lost its way? And what about the wider BBC, with cuts of about 20% or so being implemented, largely because of Rupert Murdoch's News International successfully lobbied that the BBC was unfair competition? Is the national BBC also losing its way? We hear from a former Tory minister, European commissioner, and now chair of the BBC Trust, Chris Patton, and the BBC Director General, Mark Thompson. Plus, the Fox Werity scandal that led to North Somerset MP and Defence Secretary Liam Fox being forced to resign this year. Who is Werity? What's the connection with British Ambassador to Israel, Philip Gould? And why has the story not been in the papers? Plus, we look at the corrupting global arms deal influence of BAE Systems and explore rumours that the Prime Minister David Cameron dealt South African nuclear weapons on the black market while he was working at Tory Central Office before he became an MP. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 4 Celsius and some light rain, with quite an amazing sky out there. If you're looking out towards the west, it's all clear. Beautiful. This weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, cloudier on Saturday and sunnier on Sunday. That's Christmas Day. Fairly windy. Next week, highs of 10 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells and also windy at times. Next weekend, that's the 21st of December and the 1st of January, highs of 10 Celsius, roughly staying the same temperature, with some sunny spells and showers and windy at times next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, time to introduce this week's guests. And joining us is politics graduate with a Master's in International Political Economy from Warwick, Polly Winch. Hi, Polly. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We are a politician-free zone. Polly, can you tell us a little bit about political economy and international political economy and what that means?
Okay, so I suppose the difference between, say, economics and political economy is you look at the economy as something that is inherently political. So looking at the relationships between different groups of people and how things are divided, it's basically who gets what and how much, and looking at the role of ideas in that process.
Now, you must have been following what's been going on over the last 3 years or so in the international economic situation, the economic crisis, pretty closely. Can you give us, if you can, in a nutshell, what's your view of what's gone wrong? And maybe, I mean, I shouldn't really ask you two questions at the same time, but then after that, I'll save it for afterwards. If you could just give us your own analysis as a recent graduate of what went wrong.
Okay, I don't think that the financial regulators are independent from the industry that they regulate, and I think that the regulations played a huge role in causing the crisis. I think it was intentional, and I also think that the government was involved, and you've got kind of high-level balance sheet fraud occurring.
Right, that's interesting that you say it's intentional. So, I mean, we're being told, I mean, the whole thing is really being sold to us as, oh, we're very sorry, we got it wrong. But actually, to say it was intentional is taking a bit of a different spin.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the mainstream media is, you know, kind of convincing us that this was a systemic crisis and that we've run out of money and all of this stuff. But if you actually look at the mechanics of the crisis and how it happened and the justifications, the reasons that were being given for the bailouts, you know, that is intentional. Those things were not, they weren't necessary, they weren't imperative. And so, yeah, I mean, once you actually look at the details, I think it's hard to kind of refute that, really.
The Financial Services Authority is supposed to regulate banking in Britain. So how come they weren't doing their job? I mean, in what way do you think that they're compromised?
Well, I think basically what the FSA has done, and I mean, if you look at the people working in the FSA, you've got kind of ex-chairs of the British Banking Association and things, you know, I mean, there's a revolving door.
That's an industry body which represents various banks, in fact, all the banks, all the major banks, and you're saying that the same people that are regulating it are also like the industry body. Now, you might also look at that industry body as a sort of cartel organisation where everybody can sort of get together and make decisions based on what's best for the entire industry. So maybe that's why there hasn't been the proper sort of competition in banking.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Adam Smith said this back in the 19th century, you know, is the reality is that when powerful, rich people get together and they share the same interests, then they will start to conspire. I mean, it's not, conspiracy theory has a very negative connotation and some of them are obviously wacky, but, you know, then there is common sense. And I think if you look at the revolving door between the regulator and the industries and then look at what the regulations actually, well, the role that the regulations played in the construction of the crisis, I think, you know, it's logical and anyone with any kind of reasoning can see that.
So do you think that there's been really a weak governments over the last 5 years or so that have allowed this to happen? Because actually, I mean, our representatives at the moment is George Osborne. Previously, of course, it was Alistair Darling in the previous government. They are supposed to make sure that the banking system doesn't represent private interest, but it represents the public who vote them in to be Chancellor of the Exchequer and to be the government.
I mean, absolutely. To be honest, I don't know. I'm torn. Are the politicians actually just, and I don't mean to be rude, but stupid, and do they not know what's going on? Or is there something a little bit more sinister and, you know, like you're implying, perhaps they are kind of part of it? I mean, the conclusion that I come to at the end of the day is I think they can't be that stupid. They must know. You know, when Gordon Brown authorised the bailout and, you know, kind of bought all the shares of RBS and Lloyds, I just don't think that he can have had no idea what he was doing.
And is it not maybe possible that the banking industry through the Bankers Association, etc., are just so powerful at lobbying on, you know, 20 different fronts at the same time that they're almost an unstoppable force for an individual, say like Alistair Darling or George Osborne, to actually resist?
Well, I mean, an unstoppable force. At the end of the day, if the politicians are doing their job properly, then they should be standing up. Well, they represent the people, and that's who they should be representing. So, you know, unless, I don't know, the banks have them really over a barrel in some sort of way, I don't see how they can be unstoppable. I mean, the government is supposed to be in charge.
Now, let's bring old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers in here. Hi, Martin. Now, what I'd like to do is ask you a similar question, but from a 20, 30 years ago Oxford PPE, Politics, Philosophy, Economics graduate. What's your view of the questions I've just been putting to Polly? And particularly this idea of whether it's just all a big mistake and they're very sorry, or whether actually there's, you know, deliberate collusion been going on between Treasury politicians and the banking industry?
Well, I think I agree with everything that Polly's just said, and I think that the evidence for collusion is quite strong. I mean, the dismantling, for example, of things like the Glass-Steagall Act was a conscious policy by Wall Street to get rid of regulations that they didn't like. And as a result of that, of course, casino banking and retail banking were linked together.
But that's in the US. I mean, obviously, this affects
I'm just using that as a for example of how this came about. And the politicians, at the end of the day, are answerable supposedly to the electorate, but they're also answerable to their funders in this country as in the US. And this is the point where I'd like to read out from my book, if I may, which I brought
You've got a rather crusty old looking book.
It's a crusty old book. This was actually belonged to my grandfather, this book.
Yeah.
So I inherited this book. It's called The Iron Heel, and it's by a guy called Jack London.
This is a novel.
It's a novel, yes. And Jack London was more famous for writing kind of wildlife novels, The Call of the Wild, White Fang, and so on. He was a sort of rumbustious type who was a lumberjack and a sailor and all the rest of it before he became a writer. And this book was written in 1908, and it's actually it was influential on 1984. Orwell's book 1984 was influenced by this book, and it's called The Iron Heel. The Iron Heel are the oligarchy inside the United States of America, the wealthy classes, the super rich, the gilded age.
What
people.
We might call the power elite. See,
yes,
right,
the robber barons, the robber barons. Anyway, it's a science fiction book, so it's written by the protagonist, who's actually a young woman who's writing from the future. It's been found in the future. It's a manuscript about what happened in the United States in the early part of the century. So remember, this book was published in 1908, and most of what it's talking about is what happened in the subsequent years, which was basically predicting the future in the US when Jack London wrote it. So he's writing about how the oligarchy takes... to give you a brief synopsis, the oligarchy basically take over in the US, and rather than being a utopian novel about a socialist future, it's written from a socialist future, but 300 years hence, because there are 300 years of oligarchic tyranny before you get there. So it's not a very happy book.
And so there's still...
It ends in a big massacre in Chicago where the workers' movement
is
destroyed.
At least manuscripts are still being written at the time of even after all this oligarchy. So anyway, it's your Jack and Ori moment. Off you go,
Okay,
Martha.
So this is from the book, and they're predicting what's going to happen in 1912. So for us, it would be 2012. But this is why it's interesting, because it's very similar to what we're having. It's saying, the banks themselves, constituting one of the most important forces in the oligarchy, continued to call in credits. The Wall Street group turned the stock market into a maelstrom, where the values of all the land crumbled away almost to nothingness. And out of all the wreck and ruin rose the form of the nascent oligarchy, imperturbable, indifferent, and sure. Its serenity and certitude was terrifying. Not only did it use its own vast power, but it used all the power of the United States Treasury to carry out its plans. The captains of industry had turned upon the middle class. The employers' associations that had helped the captains of industry to tear and rend labour were now turned and rent by their erstwhile allies. Amidst the crashing of the middlemen, the small businessmen and manufacturers, the trusts stood firm. Nay, the trusts did more than stand firm. They were active. They sowed wind and wind and ever more wind, for they alone knew how to reap the whirlwind and make a profit out of it. And what profits? Colossal profits. Strong enough themselves to weather the storm that was largely of their own brewing, they turned loose and plundered the wrecks that floated about them. Values were pitifully and inconceivably shrunken, and the trusts added hugely to their holdings, even extending their enterprises into many new fields, and always at the expense of the middle class. Thus, the summer of 1912 witnessed the virtual death thrust to the middle class. Even Ernest, who is the hero of the book, was astounded at the quickness with which it had been done. He shook his head ominously and looked forward without hope to the fall elections. "It's no use," he said. "We are beaten. The Iron Heel is here. I had hoped for a peaceful victory at the ballot box. I was wrong. We shall be robbed of all our few remaining liberties. The Iron Heel will walk upon our faces. Nothing remains but a bloody revolution of the working class. Of course we will win, but I shudder to think of it." And I read this book the other day, and it's been recommended to Occupy people all over the world. And it's basically, at the beginning of the 19th century, there was a similar crisis which he was addressing. And coming back to the issue that we are addressing, whether it's deliberate or not, people in those days had a much more robust idea of how politics works. And people like Jack London knew that the trusts, Wall Street, the robber barons, they did conspire. And everybody knew that they conspired. And do you know what? Nothing's changed.
Well, we've had the Vickers report this year, so hopefully something may change. That is a bunch of selected people, many of whom are actually bankers themselves, looking into how to regulate the banks, Polly. So it looks like what Martin's saying there, nothing's really changed in that we've got a system whereby everything, it seems every time one of these inquiries is set up, the word independent is put in front of it. But actually, the people who are looking into the way things should change so often seem to be actually from the oligarchy themselves. And maybe, I mean, in the Vickers situation, one of the people was Martin Taylor, who's the former head of Barclays, actually supposedly, independently, coming up with an idea, ideas about how to reform banking.
Yeah, and I think the thing with finance is it is very complicated, and one of the issues is that not many people who don't work in finance actually have the kind of knowledge that you need to regulate it. So I suppose, you know, the issue is whether you can, and this perhaps shows that we need to be more educated around finance, and that needs to start, you know, in primary school. We need to know the basic model of banking and how that works. But whether you could maybe have, because you do need people from industry in the regulatory bodies, but you also, you need all stakeholders. So you need people that use banks, you need owners of small businesses, and all of those people need to understand kind of like the building bricks of finance, I suppose. So it's not acceptable for only industry people to be involved, but I do think, you know, realistically, they kind of have to play a role in it.
Martin, what about that? Because you do have to have some people from the industry making these decisions. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that when you allow something to be so complicated that you can't understand it, that's a very good indication that you need to simplify it so it can be understood. Think about nuclear power, for example, where we listen to these people who are experts about it, and then something like Fukushima happens. Ultimately, if you can't understand it, a lot of what's gone on, actually, a lot of the scams that have gone on in this cycle of boom and bust are exactly the same as the scams of yesteryear, but just done with computers. And in actual fact, there's not that much difference. And the regulators have been captured, as Polly says. My real fear at the moment is that talking about regulating the banking system in the medium term is irrelevant, because I was reading earlier that the Eurozone banks have been soaking up money from the European Central Bank over the last 24, 48 hours. It hasn't actually done anything for the euro. And the problem is that the banks are absolutely bust. They're trading as effectively bankrupt institutions, and the politicians have allowed that to happen, and they don't know what to do now, and they don't know how to stop it. And all this talk about regulation is in a perfect world. We would talk about what we're going to do to regulate them, presuming that they're basically stable. They're not stable. They're going to crash, and they need to think about what they're going to do. And I know that the Treasury in this country and other countries are staying late over Christmas. What are we going to do if the banks crash? And that's the problem that most people haven't grasped, including the politicians.
The big solution is being proffered as Vickers, but I mean, one of the big problems with it is it doesn't look like it's going to be actually implemented until 2019.
Well, exactly, and the crash is going to happen next week.
I mean, Martin, you talk about, like, if the crash happens, like, it's going to happen and it's something that's totally unexpected and we're going to have to pick up the pieces. But going back to what I was saying earlier, if it's something intentional, then it's something that is planned. And,
yes,
you know, you're talking about kind of these European banks soaking up money, but actually, you know, the banks, I mean, a bank runs, it runs on debt, basically. Yep. You know, it takes in deposits, keeps like the deposits, and then lends out more than it's actually holding. So I don't see how, you know, the banks have gone bust. And if we keep throwing money into them, you know, that I appreciate you said that won't change anything, but I just don't think, I really do think that it's been intentional, that you can keep on throwing money at it, and really that's just a really kind of effective psychological
Isn't there a sort of even more fundamental problem here, you two, and that is that actually this, if you're in the know and you're in the City of London, you can actually make a fantastic amount of money out of other people's misery, and isn't that something that's sort of
absolutely
hardwired into the system?
It's all politicised now. The decisions by the European Commission, for example, are entirely political decisions, and therefore it's not actually about a market at all. It's about, do you have advance notice of agreements that are going to be made and so on. And if it is intentional, the crash will come at a time to suit the insiders so that they will actually walk away with the loot.
But,
and that's probably what is going to happen.
But then do you not think it's perhaps more about profit, more than about profit. I mean, there's a guy who he reads politics at Oxford. His name's Andrew Gamble, and he talks about crises as a social event, as things that we construct for ourselves, and it represents like a political emergency, essentially. So, I mean, you can. I think it goes beyond profit, and I do think it was intentional. The reasons why it's happened now, I don't know, and what's going to come out of it, none of us know. But you know, I think we need to be careful in saying, you know, they're just greedy. It's all about profit. I think it's much more ideological than that.
Geopolitics. Yeah. So it's not just about making an immediate profit. It's about creating a situation where in the world, for example, we're all being having a gun held against our heads now, saying your welfare state that you've enjoyed for the last 40 years, drop it. Move
but
away
who's
from the
saying
welfare
that?
State.
The banks or the government?
Both of them, because the government's in the pockets of the banks, and this is what we're dealing
well,
with.
Well, this is where I disagree with you, because it's the government that's saying that. I mean, the banks, there's been a crisis, but it's the government that's choosing to respond to it in this particular way.
Yeah, but they're responding to it in that way because the banks actually pull the strings behind the scenes. They've got an agenda of neoliberalising the world, which is not just a... And they use the crisis as a means... Have you read Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine?
Yeah.
Yeah? This is a big version of The Shock Doctrine. So what should have happened 4 years ago when the banks collapsed is everybody should have gone, my goodness, this neoliberal philosophy, load of rubbish. And that's what I thought might happen. But of course it hasn't been. What they're doing now is saying, because the banks have collapsed, we've got to have more neoliberalism.
So can you just explain this whole thing of the shock doctrine, Martin? I mean, I don't know how many people have got Naomi Klein's shock doctrine on their Christmas book list, but certainly I haven't got a copy of it at home. Right, so can you just run us through what that's about?
Very briefly, she started to write a book about the effects of the tsunami in Sri Lanka. So she went to Sri Lanka to research it, and what she found was that the tsunami, far from being a disaster to big powerful interests in the country, was being used so that, for example, fishing villages have been swept away, so now we can build a hotel where there used to be a fishing village. And then she started to work her way through and realised that in actual fact most of the shocks, like the Hurricane Katrina collapse in New Orleans and so on, that capitalism has become disaster capitalism. So the disasters allow you to push through stuff that you'd never be allowed to push through otherwise. So, for example, in New Orleans, the public school system was completely destroyed, and they've brought in a new kind of voucher system which the right wing have been pushing for years. And they've basically not allowed the inner city population back into the inner city. They've got them all in camps around the country, and the inner city is now going to be turned into a property developer's paradise. And, of course, the crashes of capitalism itself then become an excuse to do even more pursuit of this privatisation, liberalisation agenda. And that's very much what's happened over the last 4 years. The crisis has been used to push forward things like we can't afford a national health service anymore and so on.
But I do think that it's the government that's saying that, and I don't...
Well, yes, because the government are part of the game. They're very much part of it, but
I think what Martin's saying here is essentially that the government are kind of front men for the banks. And what do you think about that concept there?
Well, I appreciate that there's lobbying that goes on, but I mean that happens in from lots of industries. You know, you've got huge reforms going on in the NHS, and actually I disagree. You've got huge reforms going on in the NHS being lobbied by, you know, kind of big healthcare providers, and I'm not sure that it is just a case of the politicians are in the pockets of the bank. You know, there's lots of powerful actors, there's lots of different industries,
but they tend to coordinate their demands, because they do. The Washington Consensus, you'll know what I mean by that, which is the kind of this is how you've got to run economic policy, and it's been rammed down the throat of third world countries for 30 years, and that Washington Consensus is thrashed out in their think tanks, in the Council on Foreign Relations, in the Trilateral Commission, in the Bilderberg Group. So they don't just have that. What they get all of these different lobbies together, and the private healthcare lobby is subordinated to the banking lobby, and they all work together.
Isn't that actually a bit naughty using the word consensus? Because it's a very artificial consensus.
Well,
when
consensus
you're going around tapping people on the shoulder and saying we want you to be part of this consensus, we want you. It's not really in any way a social thing. It's a business elite consensus, isn't it?
Well, it is. It doesn't include the ordinary people. They're the ones who are being swindled.
So what do you make of what Martin's saying here? I want you to pull him apart, Polly. Go on.
Well, perhaps I'm naive, and that's the naivety of youth, but I don't think that every single person with power and money an influence can be necessarily, you know, some kind of demon that needs to be feared, who is, you know, deliberately working to screw us all over. And I think as well, and history has shown this, that you often get fractures within the elites, and that's when you get really massive change. And I think that's where we might be heading.
Well, I think that's right. There's the Soros wing of the elite is much more liberal minded than the more kind of Bush end of the elite, if you like.
But they're ideologically completely opposed.
Yeah, they're not ideologically completely opposed, because they're still in favour of free markets and so on and so forth. But think about somebody like Jeffrey Sachs, who wanders around in the middle there between the two extremes. I mean, in Eastern Europe he was hated because he brought in a lot of free market philosophy, which a lot of people when I worked over there were very negative about. But of course he's now tacked away to the left and said, well, I never meant to say that. What I really meant to say was that we need to get more aid going and so on and so forth. So I'm not suggesting that the elite are homogenous, but they do have certain interests in common.
But you're talking about free markets, like we live in, you know, the 19th century kind of liberalism where there are really free markets. No. I mean, we don't have anything close to free market economics at the moment. I mean, everything is incredibly regulated, and the regulations tend to favour the powerful.
Yes.
I think if we did have free markets and things were allowed to go bankrupt, like capitalism is supposed to happen, I think we might see a very different kind of political economy.
Well, that's right. But I mean, the reason why they won't let capitalism go bankrupt is because they don't believe their own propaganda. Their propaganda is when capitalism goes bankrupt, it just spontaneously regenerates. But none of them really believe in that, because when capitalism goes bankrupt, as it did in the 1930s, people start asking the question, why have we got capitalism at all? And that's why they're trying to keep the show on the road, because when it does go bankrupt, then there begins the all or nothing question, do we want this system at all? And they don't want that question asked, which is why they've chucked money at the private markets to keep the capitalist show on the road, but not as a capitalist show. It's long ago become socialism for the wealthy. I mean, think of all the money transfers that are involved in bailing out the banks with taxpayers' money in the European Union. That's the ordinary folk who are being asked to make the payment. But of course it won't work, because if you drain demand out of the economy by squeezing the ordinary folks, you ain't going to get it to work anyway.
I mean, you talk about in the 1930s, you know, businesses were allowed to go bankrupt, but as I understand it, it started with the Great Crash in October 1929. Now, that was just a stock market crash. So it was because in the papers and stuff, it's lost this much value, you know, this business is worth this much less. But actually, at the end of the day, you still had the factory there, you still had the people there. I don't think things were allowed to go bankrupt, actually. I don't think that's what happened.
Well, they didn't go bankrupt because Roosevelt stepped in and said exactly what you said. We've got the people, we've got the plant, and we are going to use it. And of course, he had to fight against Wall Street interests to do that. And there was an attempted coup against Roosevelt by people around Prescott Bush, who is the grandfather of W. Bush. And it was all hushed up at the time, but General Smedley Butler, who was in the US Marine Corps, he was approached by this coup plotters to get rid of Roosevelt, and he went along with it to the extent of finding out what they were up to. And even though he was a conservative himself, he then went to Roosevelt and said, look, these people are plotting against you. And they were in fact prevented from taking over, and it was all hushed up. But in fact, there is lots of documentary evidence that that's what happened. So there is tension. The politicians sometimes do turn and say, we're not having this. But then, of course, other forces then come into play. And what nearly happened in the US in the 1930s is what happened in all of Latin America in the 1930s and in the 1960s. And it could have happened in the US. In fact, I think it has happened in the US, but in a soft way. The military have taken over. The Homeland Security State is there.
So, I mean, but Obama doesn't represent the military, surely, Martin. I mean, you know, he's been elected by the American people. What are you talking about?
But he's also reneged on everything he promised when he was elected.
Well, he has gone back on quite a lot,
because his main funders, the biggest funders of his campaign were Wall Street in general, and the biggest single funder of his campaign was Goldman Sachs, which is why he's got Tim Geithner as his Treasury Secretary.
I thought he was funded by people giving little $5 donations across America.
That was just the propaganda when he was getting going. Is ultimately what happens with the big banks is they bet anybody who looks like winning, they chuck money at them.
Ultimately,
sure they get control of them when they get there.
I think it's important to draw a line between banks and then institutions like Goldman Sachs, which deal solely in imaginary
Sachs
money.
Goldman Sachs be reclassified as a bank, otherwise they couldn't get any bailout money. So they actually claim that they are a bank, even though they're not, and they've had to do that, otherwise they wouldn't be entitled to any bailout money at all. And they've had the lion's share of it as well.
Yeah, but I think that line is important to draw, because actually small businesses and people like myself and you, you know, we need banks. We can't just get rid of banks.
Retail banking is a perfectly legitimate activity. But what happens, of course, what you were saying earlier about how the fractional reserve banking, where they lend out more than they've actually got, there used to be rules about that. It was about one, you know, it had to be about a 10 to 1 ratio. But they're now up to 40, 50 to 1. And that, of course, is a recipe for disaster. It always was a recipe for disaster, which is why they weren't previously allowed to do it.
I think the real recipe for disaster is the fact that money isn't backed by anything tangible, but with something with a finite limit. So this is why you've got kind of hedge funds, I mean, making, you know, billions and billions and billions of pounds profit in 20 seconds through a computer algorithm. If you had money backed by something tangible that was finite, that wouldn't be able to happen. Well, I think that's why you've got such searing inequality.
Well, if you think back to the Bretton Woods system as set up in 1946, gold was the standard, but it was against the dollar. I mean, Keynes wanted bancor. He wanted a currency which was not belonging to any individual country. But the US weren't going to have that, and they were the world's creditors at that stage, and they could make the rules. But the point was that it was fixed to the gold standard. So you have flexibility in the system. So you could print dollars, you could boost the economy, but it was still linked to gold ultimately. But of course, Nixon took the dollar off gold in 1971 because they couldn't afford to fight the Vietnam War. Basically, they'd been beaten, and they'd have to, you know, basically, if they followed the rules of the Bretton Woods system, they would have to withdraw because they didn't have any money left. You know, the Viet Cong had won. But they didn't want to do that. They wanted to fight on, for God knows for what reason, because they still had to lose in the end. But they broke the whole world's financial system away from having a link at that point. Mm. And of course, don't forget that currencies also were fixed but floating. Mm. So there was a managed system. Which has been, they threw that managed system down the drain, and then the other big turning point was the big bang in the 80s and the Reagan-Thatcher era, and those two events have precipitated us where we are now.
Yeah, well, the creation of money just became totally detached from anything that was occurring in reality. You had money that was pregnant with itself, just creating more money. Yes, I mean, now in the point
done,
of
it's also being done by private institutions who've got a vested interest in pumping up bubbles and bursting them, so that because the state had basically subcontracted it to them and said, well, it's nothing to do with us.
So the point, perhaps, is not kind of the solution that Vickers is proposing, because really, what would that solve? But is actually tying the creation of money back to things that are happening in reality, the production of real goods.
Yeah, a thoroughgoing financial reform, like the people talking about, the Bank of England Act is being put forward by the monetary reform people.
There's quite a few groups around which have been talking about this for 20 years or so, monetary reform campaigns. It's called Positive Money, this particular one you're talking about, the Bank of England Act. And we had Ben Curtis in here last year, I think it was, talking about that. But essentially, I mean, when I ask this question to both of you, because I find it impossible, if I was a bank and I was able to create money out of nowhere and lend it out at interest and then obviously collect more of that interest back, I can't see how a bank can possibly go bust, since it's able to actually create money out of nowhere and lend it out at interest. Martin,
well,
you
can go on for a long while doing that, but eventually all the debts add up and they have to be paid, and you get a turning point where debt deflation sets in, and then you get, instead of getting leverage...
So what's debt deflation? Come on, what's debt deflation?
Debt deflation means that there's so much debt in the system that you reach the point where it can be a straw that breaks the camel's back at that point. And then, of course, it all filters back through the system, because it is all based on nothing. And
it's not based on nothing, it's based on confidence. The confidence that you'll be able to go to the bank and withdraw your savings
if you need to.
So the only way it can go bust is if every single person does that at the same time. Well, the only way that can happen is if confidence
question of confidence. Confidence in the system is kept going at the moment because, for example, the European Central Bank decided it would buy bonds 2 days ago, and if they hadn't done that, it would have crashed. So what's happening is that coming back to the geopolitics of this, the European Central Bank has yet to seriously print money in the same way as the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve. So what the Anglo-American financiers want, they want the Europeans to basically print money in the same way as the Anglo-Americans do. The Germans are very resistant to this, even though the European Central Bank has started breaking its own rules to buy up these bonds. But I mean, there's more giving the system. If they can persuade the European governments to bail the banks out one more time, they can kick the can up the road one more time. But then there really will be no more money to pump into the system.
I don't know how you can say, on the one hand, that there is confidence in the system because, you know, they're getting the bailouts, when the whole point is that it is because people believe that the banks need money that the bailouts are kind of necessitated. I mean, if there had been no news about this, nothing about it, I agree with Tony that the banks could not have gone bust.
it is all ultimately about confidence, but it's not just about confidence. I mean, they've had a bank run in Latvia a couple of months ago. I mean, you could get bank runs, but I mean, people basically, the system, as long as the state is willing to underpin the system, then people, that's what's happened for 4 years. People think, oh, right, phew, the banks are not going to go bust. They are bust if you actually look at the books. They've been allowed.
I don't know what you mean by they're bust.
Because they've been allowed to mark to magic a lot of the derivatives that they are holding. Yeah.
Well, this is what the quantitative easing has been. A lot of it has been buying up these derivatives and junk that actually isn't really worth anything in order to prop the banks up.
Yes,
but this QE2.
This is just like a psychological tool, right? It's a new form, if you want to put it in your language, a new form of kind of class warfare, perhaps, right?
Yes.
So now you don't have strikes, well, you do, but you don't kind of have the fight going on at the picket lines. What you have is the widespread belief that this money needs to go into the banks because otherwise everything's going to collapse and the world's going to fall around us. Without that belief,
that's the hegemony.
That money's not necessary.
That is the hegemony of the ruling class. I mean, we're still not.
But you're perpetuating it to a certain extent.
No, what I'm saying is that I don't think that the Europeans should bail out the banks. I think we've been bailing them out far too much. I mean, the only justification for bailing out the banks in the first place is if you were going to reform the banks immediately, not in 10 years' time, immediately take control of them. They've not done that. Therefore, there's no point chucking good money after bad here. We might as well go through what we've got to go through, our visit to the dentist, which is the collapse of the banking system, which is not going to be fun, but that's where we're going, whether we like it or not.
I'm sorry, last thing I'll say, I just think that a thorough understanding of how banking works and the fact that it runs on confidence, and as long as that confidence is there, then a bank cannot go bust, really would solve our problems.
Yes, but the problem is that the confidence is not going to be sustained because the banks are bust, and ultimately despite because the reason why Dexia Bank was passed all the stress tests and it's gone bust. They are,
what is a stress test if not a tool to show, oh, you know, that you can't have confidence in this bank because under this completely unlikely, ridiculous scenario, it wouldn't have enough money. Yeah, I mean, that's just too many ifs and buts.
Well,
and the whole point is to not introduce those ifs and buts into finance.
I think, Polly, that the banks are going to go bust because they are bust. And at a certain point, reality kicks in. You know, gravity, you know, it's like the cartoon character walking over the edge of the cliff and looking down. And when they look down, they're going to go down. Now, they've had 4 years, the political leadership, to get a grip on this situation. All they've done is basically given in to all of the demands of this rapacious oligarchy because, for whatever reason, because they're paid off, whatever.
Right.
But the fact is that is not going to work. The banks are going to go bust, and then we will raise questions.
Right, that's enough from you for a minute, Martin. We're just going to let Polly have the last word. Then we're going to have some music, and then we're going to look at Vickers and the Vickers report in the Houses of Parliament this week. Okay, Polly, final word.
Okay, Martin. You cannot say, I don't believe, on the one hand, that the crisis is intentional, and on the other hand, that all the banks are going to go bust and this is systemic, without being part of that intentionality yourself.
OK, Martin, I've switched your microphone off, I'm afraid, because that was Polly's last word, and we're going to have some music now.
They said there'll be snow at Christmas. They said there'll be peace on earth. But instead it just kept on raining. A veil of tears for the virgin birth. I remember one Christmas morning, a winter's light and a distant choir. The peal of a bell and that Christmas tree smell. Eyes full of tinsel and fire. They sold me a dream of Christmas. They sold me a silent night. They told me a fairy story, till I believed in the Israelite. And I believed in Father Christmas. I looked to the sky with excited eyes. Then I woke with a yawn in the first light of dawn, and I saw him in his disguise. Thank you.
wish you a hopeful Christmas. I wish you a brave new year. All anguish, pain and sadness, leave your heart and let your road be clear. They said there'd be snow at Christmas. They said there'd be peace on earth. Hallelujah, Noel, be heaven on earth. All the Christmas we get, we deserve.
I think that was quite a long time ago, wasn't it? That was Greg Lake from in a slightly separate entity to Emerson, Lake and Palmer, I Believe in Father Christmas. And of course, Father Christmas is almost like the Vicar's Report in a way. Is this actually going to be real? Is it going to make any difference? Polly, you first. What are your thoughts about this? Because this is being held out as the great, you know, this is the Conservative Party's great answer to the economic crisis. Everything's going to be different after this Vicar's Report is implemented.
Well, I think it shows a lack of understanding about what caused the crisis, to be honest. You know, you can separate investment banking. You were talking earlier, Martin, about casino banking from retail banking. And this casino banking word is getting thrown around quite a lot. And I think it's a dangerous term because it implies that, you know, this money can literally disappear as if we were in a casino, and that when that happens, we need to throw more money at it. So, yeah, OK.
But money doesn't actually disappear in a casino, does it? It goes to the owner of the casino. If it's disappeared off your, you know, in front of you, I'm not that I'm a frequenter of casinos, but I thought that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the thing is like you were talking earlier about the derivatives and stuff, is that the money isn't actually real. It's literally numbers on a balance sheet, numbers on a screen, and for as long as we all kind of give it this reality, then it doesn't matter whether it's real or not, because it acts as we all act as if it were. Now, once we kind of start realising, no, this isn't real, and I think I said this last time I was on the show, we write it down, then, you know, the kind of this casino idea goes away. Now, I think with Vickers, you can separate investment banking from retail banking. I think that's a fairly sensible idea, but I don't think that it addresses the causes of the crisis at all.
So what would, do you think?
Well, I think looking at at the moment, the main thing is this capital ratio, and the capital of a bank is defined as its shares and its debt. Now, the more debt the bank is in, the more it owes to other parties, the more capital it has. So we've literally got a situation where everything is upside down. You know, what's black is being called white, and I think that's what needs to be addressed.
Well, I totally agree. I think that the Vickers report is too little, too late, and went way too late, because it's 4 years in the future, and the crisis is now, and they haven't actually got any answers to what they're going to do now, apart from run around like headless chickens. And ultimately, we've got to rebuild the banking system as a public interest industry. It's a key industry. It's like the bloodstream of the economy, and it can't afford to be in the hands of these private interests who've got their own agenda.
Well, Conservative Chancellor George Osborne gave a report to MPs in the House of Commons on Monday, so we're going to have a listen to that now, plus some of the replies from various people like Alistair Darling, Ed Balls, and others. And so here is Peter Mulligan from Monday's Today in Parliament on Radio 4 talking about the Vickers report by George Osborne.
The British people are angry about what happened in our banks and angry at the politicians who let it happen. This coalition government sees two parties working together to clear up the mess of the past and to create a banking system that protects taxpayers and serves customers better. Today we present the most far-reaching changes to banking in our modern history, so we can build an economy that works for everyone. And I commend this statement to the House.
Mr. Speaker, we on this side of the House have apologised for the part the last government played in this global regulatory failure. In that same cross-party spirit, Mr. Speaker, perhaps the Chancellor would like to take this opportunity to apologise too for the role his party played in opposition, and he played as Shadow Chancellor in complaining of too much regulation, and in the case of the then Leader of the Opposition, calling as late as the spring of 2008 for lower taxes and less regulation for the city, Mr. Speaker.
The Chancellor at that time was Labour's Alistair Darling. He had a warning about the Vickers plan.
This would not have stopped the failure of Northern Rock or HBOS, and the idea that a future government might decline to have to step in and rescue an investment bank if it failed is simply not credible. Look what happened to Lehman's when the Americans tried that. So these problems haven't gone away.
The idea of ring-fencing the retail operations focused on the UK will give, we believe, and Vickers believes, and many others believe, the Chancellor of the day greater opportunity to protect what really matters to the UK economy without having to resort to bailing out the entire institution.
And he thought the Coalition was handling the Vickers report well. The Labour MP Dennis Skinner, though, had his doubts.
Isn't there a possibility that if the banks are split up, there will be more top bankers than there are now? What we need in Britain are small business growth, large business growth. The chances are that the most reviled group of people in the land are going to multiply, the top bankers.
Mr. Osborne doubted that. The senior Conservative, Michael Fallon, referred to a recent report by the Financial Services Authority, which named Tony Blair, Gordon Brown and Ed Balls for opposing tighter regulation before the banking crash.
The Chancellor agree with me that if the three politicians identified as culpable in the RBS report had been serving in local government, they would probably have been surcharged.
Well, two of those three politicians are now busy earning quite a lot of money in the financial sector to deal with the fact they might face a surcharge, and maybe with the effort of my colleagues we can make sure the third politician soon follows them.
That was George Osborne there finishing that report from Today in Parliament from Monday. Martin, this whole business of the Vickers report, there's all sorts of stuff there, but the main thing surely is that it's just simply not going to happen for another 4 years. But I mean, what about Alistair Darling's point there, that actually if Vickers were implemented, now or even several years ago, that it wouldn't have stopped the HBOS or Northern Rock crises?
Well, I think that comes back to Polly's point earlier, that the root of the crisis isn't just lack of regulation and all the rest of it. It's the way in which money is created within the system as a whole. And now is the time to actually question the whole system. What they're doing is belatedly starting to agree to regulations which are common sense, but it's a bit too late. It's stable door, horse, bolted. The crash is going to happen next week, or certainly early in the new year.
But they're Martin, you've been talking about this crash again and again. You've been talking about the last 2 years. There's still no crash.
Yeah,
and anyway,
surely
if it's in the bank's interest to continue going, they will find ways to just completely...
The reason why it's going to happen is because if they could successfully pass the cost of all of this onto the population, they would have another lease of life. But the problem is by creating deflation in places like Greece, you make the debt situation worse, which is why they've reached the end of the line. If they could squeeze more money out of the Greeks than the Greeks were getting in as bailout, then they could probably carry
on.
But
now Goldman Sachs is running Greece. Surely they may have a chance of doing that.
No, because the point is that when they push through these policies of austerity, they actually make the debt worse. And that's the same is going to happen with Osborne's policy. The debt in Britain is going to get worse. And at that point, the game is up. So even attempts to pass the burden onto the ordinary population are self-defeating. And at that point, the system crashes.
Okay, Polly, you've got a slightly brighter view of the future, less quite chaotic than Martin. What are your thoughts about what you just heard there from Monday in Parliament?
Well, I wonder if, kind of like I was saying before, are these politicians just, stupid, or are they kind of pulling the wool over our eyes? I mean, George Osborne said on that clip that it was the most far-reaching change in our generation, the Vickers suggestions. Now, I mean, finance wasn't even regulated. I mean, Martin, when you were at university, there were no regulations for finance. There were no crashes, there were no bank runs, early warnings. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the most far-reaching change was in 1988. when all the heads of the central banks got together, they formed a committee, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, and they set these capital ratios. And the first problem they had was in deciding what to define capital as. And it was at that meeting that they decided that capital would be debt. So the more debt a bank issued, the more shares a bank issued, the more capital it had. Now, that's what we're actually doing at the moment. We are buying the bank's debt. These are the bailouts. So if that's not the most far-reaching change in our generation, then I don't know what is. So my first point is I'm not sure if George Osborne really knows what he's talking about.
Okay, Martin, this whole idea of banks just simply issuing debt, and the more debt they issue, the more they're allowed to lend to people, etc. I mean, that does sound a little bit perverse, doesn't it? Because it's almost like they're encouraged to sort of create this fictional money to get even more in debt. And actually, you know, ultimately, surely, every bank that goes down that road eventually is going to crash.
Yes, and of course, it all began in the 80s. Walter Wriston, when he was head of Citibank, said, We don't make loans, we make money. And they're classified in the literature as money centre banks. And they're called money centre banks because they create money. These derivatives contracts, which they've been writing, have been basically changing hands as if they were money. And the government long ago lost control over what they are or what the implications of them would be. And it's too late to... these regulations should never have been... There were regulations from the 30s and they were gradually dismantled. So you got to a situation where there wasn't where regulations which had been in place were removed.
Well, what sort of regulations? Because we heard from Polly that they weren't...
Well, I mean, for example, you used to have an insurable interest in something if you were going to insure it. So if you're going to insure something like your house, your car, your business, you've actually got to be the owner. But what's happened with derivatives contracts is you can buy cheap insurance and also you can buy insurance on somebody else's stuff. So I will take a bet that your business is going to go down, even though in fact I don't actually have any interest in that business at all. Now, that was a regulation. You see, insurance companies are supposed to be backed up by loans, you know, Lloyd's names, whatever, and they only insure an insurable interest. But the derivatives market allows people to take bets on failure, never mind success, of other people's things. Now, that is actually completely forbidden under the previous regulations. And Brooksley Bourne, who was the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission when these derivatives first started coming through the system,
that's US Stock Exchange regulator.
Yeah, she said, well, we can't do any of this. This is all wrong. You know, the regulations don't allow it. And she had her arm twisted and she was kicked aside. And they said, no, this is all really, really clever, really safe. And, of course, it was all absolutely wrong in terms of traditional banking practice.
Because
it should never have been allowed to happen.
You know, certainly my understanding, Polly, is that one of the problems we're in now is that some of the regulations have just been sort of pulled out ever since Gordon Brown took over as Chancellor when Labour was elected in 97 and then handed the power to set interest rates over to the Bank of England, that the regulations that the government have been doing, the Treasury have been doing, have actually been slowly dismantled, not the other way around, as you seem to be implying.
Well, that's because that's what I think, actually. I don't think that the regulations... I mean, there's this whole discourse of deregulation, but things are becoming more and more regulated. And, you know, you can kind of regulate derivatives all you want, but for as long as you have a situation in which money can just create money and it can kind of disappear or appear in an instant and on a whim and through a computer algorithm, then it doesn't matter what kind of regulations you have, because that situation is completely unsustainable.
That's quite right.
Now,
regulation is not enough.
Let's have a look at, because basically what we're saying is that we need a complete wholesale reform of the monetary system. Is
Absolutely.
That something you both agree with or not?
I think we do.
Yeah, I think we do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's good to know that there are actually campaigns out there who have been talking about this. I mean, one of the magazines that I get, I think it's about every 2 months, is Sustainable Economics, which is not really like The Economist magazine, which you'll see in every WH Smith right across the world, pretty much. The Economist is very much pushed out there as a magazine about money. But Brian Leslie's, I think he was originally part of the Green Party, but he promotes this little magazine, which has got loads of completely counter information to The Economist magazine. Do you want to say something about The Economist, Martin? Because one of my bugbears with it is that there are no bylines. So if you wanted to question something that an individual journalist is saying in The Economist, you can't. You simply can't.
Well,
you have to phone up the newspaper or try and get through. But the journalists aren't actually identified, so nobody knows who's writing the articles in the paper.
Well, that's true. But can I pick up on the Mervyn King, head of the Bank of England? He is on the record as saying we've got to question fractional reserve banking. Now, Mervyn King, as the head of the Bank of England, he's a civil servant, really, rather than a banker. And he's you know, being, I mean, when he was questioned by the Commons Committee about all of this, he said, you know, I'm supposed to take away the punch bowl when you're all getting excited. But if I'd come here 4 years ago and said, we're going to take away the punch bowl, we're not going to allow you to do all these things, you'd have all been on my case. And that was true. What we saw earlier is all the politicians there are pointing fingers at each other for being in favour of deregulation of the financial markets. And of course, they can all point fingers at each other because they all were in favour of it.
So one of the things you seem to be saying, Polly, is that we need to go back to a system whereby money is actually backed by something tangible, such as gold or whatever. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I really think that that is the kind of only answer that is, you know, feasible and sustainable in the long run. And like, since 1971, you were talking about Nixon detying the dollar from gold. I mean, since then, you've seen searing inequality. Now, that is because I truly believe money can make money. People are making huge profits out of the financial markets. And it's just literally, you know, like I've said, digits on a screen, it's a line on a graph, it's just a graphic. But that graphic and those numbers in those people's bank accounts actually allow them to live a lifestyle that's just well beyond, really unfair.
What's happened in Marx's terms is that the financial sector of the ruling class has actually snaffled far more of the surplus value than the industrial investors and so on. And it's the fire insurance and real estate sector has now actually become the dominant sector.
But the thing is it's not just the financial sector. I mean, what you've got since, say, like Thatcher kind of put all the pensions into the financial markets, it's not just the financial sector that's screwing everybody over. The reality is that you can make more money, you get a higher return by investing in the capital markets than you do investing in a company that makes
productive
goods.
And you get an
even
higher return if you invest in illegal drugs, which then gets washed through the banking system.
Yeah, I mean, all right.
As you know, from economic theory, investment will flow to where super profits are to be found.
Yeah.
Super profits are to be found A, in the drugs industry, B, in the financial industry. You'd be a fool to invest in a better widget. You're never going to make any money doing that. And that's because the system has become distorted in favour of speculation rather than long-term investment in producing goods and services.
But the reason why you can make such high returns in the capital markets is because money isn't backed by anything tangible. And that's why these huge profits and huge losses, that's why that's possible.
Yeah, but I mean, if we go back immediately to a gold standard, in a way, if a crash happens, that's what will happen. The gold will shoot through the roof. And then it could be used as the basis for a new system.
I mean, the thing that is so perverse about this, of course, is that there are many people out there living on the poverty line to whom money is absolutely crucial in order to buy food for their family, to pay the gas bill, to stay warm, you know, so they don't freeze over Christmas, particularly vulnerable people out there. And yet, on the other side of the spectrum, we've got these investment bankers who are kind of juggling with money, making it up by just simply pressing a button on a keyboard. Now, it sounds to me almost like a sort of little private club, like we have the money. And this is a very dangerous sort of situation, surely, when you've got a private club of private interests that are running the system. And as you've pointed out, Polly, quite clearly, the Treasury, which is supposed to be working in our interest, is really very, very weak. Do you want to just reply to what you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that fair for me to put it like that, do you think?
Yeah, and I think you're totally right. And I mean, I was saying earlier, you know, it's not just all about profit and about greed, but actually a lot of it is. And huge profits are being made from this. And you're right, you know, it's perverse and it's unethical. And kind of the widening inequality that we've seen since the 1970s is, you know, really, really kind of...
dysfunctional.
Well,
apart
yeah.
from anything else.
Yeah, and it's a real tragedy actually, because there is enough wealth and there is enough for everybody to live a decent quality of life, and the situation that we've got now is terrible.
Isn't it a sort of unadulterated greed?
Well, it's not just greed. Greed has always been the same. Human nature's always been the same. It's the opportunities for that greed by having a system that allows cheaters to win. Yeah, look at Enron. They were cooking their books. They were basically doing pretty much what the banks are doing, pretending that they were making huge profits when they weren't. Structured investment vehicles. They created a whole series of different sets of books. And of course, when they were doing that, everybody else had to do the same if they want to keep up with Enron.
Let's look at the whole
system becomes corrupted completely very quickly.
Let's look at this mis-selling a couple of weeks ago by HSBC, for example, where they were mis-selling financial investments to elderly people. Those investments would only mature in 5 or 7 years, and they knew that those people only had a life expectancy of 1 or 2 years, and so they were completely mis-selling. Now, that was identified, number one, which is quite difficult because these organisations are very, very secretive, well, they're all commercial confidentiality. But secondly, the fine was not even close to the amount of commission which had been paid to the people that were selling them. It sounds appalling.
I think it's actually kind of sick. And what's even sicker about it is the fact that nobody even goes to prison for this. I mean, who is in charge of that decision?
Okay. And sorry, going to have to stop you there. We got the news. Rupert Murdoch's Sky News at 6 o'clock. We'll be resuming this after we've heard from him.
It's BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM.